Ray Darrell on Brooklyn's Radio.
Paul Howes and Tony Heath from Zone Records, and we were speaking to them in intimate detail. It's all about that wonderful legendary film star and singer Doris Day, of which their knowledge is second to none. Good evening, Paul. Good evening, Tony.
Good evening, Ray.
Mention, she was born in 1922, as has been widely publicised just recently with the discovery of her correct birth certificate. and basically, while she was appearing in some local events, band leader Barney Rapp heard her. And he was quite well known at that time, and he offered her a job to sing at his nightery, about giving her about $25 a night or something like that. And it was him, in fact, that got her to change her name, because obviously she was born Doris Kappelhoff.
Yes, yeah.
And that wasn't going to look too good on the holding, so he suggested, after she sang a song called Day After Day, not Day by Day, as some people quote, that she changed her surname today. So that's how Doris Day became Doris Day.
I mean, it's those little bits of information that I think are of interest to a lot of people, because otherwise, I mean, not everybody sort of has got a computer and sort of looks on the internet.
Oh, well, yes, but I mean, obviously, you know, I've read many things about her over the years, being a little bit of a fan, as you can guess.
Yeah, and I would never have known, but still.
And, yeah, she spent quite some time with Barney Rapp, and then following that she migrated to singing with Bob Crosby, and then eventually she got her big break with Les Brown. And of course that's where he met her in New York in around about 1940, and an odd little fact is their first appearance together was in fact on the same bill as Gypsy Rose Lee at Mike Todd's Theatre Cafe in Chicago. I find that incredible that Gypsy Rose Lee and Doris Day were on the same bill. I hope Doris was looking the other way.
Probably wouldn't have happened later, would it? No, so. I mean, that was Bob Crosby and his Bobcats.
And so there she was at that time, and in fact that's where she met her first husband, and because Doris was in fact married four times over the years, so he was called Al Jordan, and he was also the father to Doris's only son Terry. And but unfortunately, as was to be the case with all of her other marriages, it wasn't a good union, and in fact of all the marriages Al Jordan was the one that treated her the worst, because he really was prone to being terribly jealous and flying into tempers and things, and in fact it all ended quite badly, so
I find it quite difficult to believe, you know, that, I mean, she had such an unhappy domestic life in many respects, and yet she was able to go out and appear bubbly and bouncy in front of everybody else as though nothing was amiss.
Well, I think that's what the whole attraction about Doris is that she, whether you see her in movies or particularly for me, if you listen to her singing, it's mainly her singing in my case that I'm really into. It's just so uplifting.
It is.
And it's hard to kind of describe, really. But
she doesn't have to put any energy into doing that, to get that across. No. It's just so natural.
Yeah, but I've yet to meet anybody that would say they didn't like Doris Day. It's really odd.
Well, you have had people say that because they're jealous.
Oh, well,
and then
maybe,
they slag people down and call them all sorts of things. But I think it's just jealousy, that.
No, I mean, she's just got such a remarkable voice. Obviously, in the early days, it was a little different. If you hear some of the very, very first recordings, you know, everybody was singing in a very similar way, you know, like they all sounded like Vera
Lynn. Like the orchestras as well, wasn't it? I mean, they all sounded so dated, really.
It was a question then of having to sing very clearly so you were heard.
Yes.
But her style then developed, because she in fact left Les Brown for a while, but then after marrying Al Jordan, but then of course with all those problems, eventually she tried to do some other work, and then Les Brown asked it to go back again. So it was the second part of being with Les Brown that eventually culminated in her recording Sentimental Journey with Les Brown.
Yes.
And, of course, that became her very first million seller.
That's right, it did, yes.
And and again, she found her second husband with the band, a guy called George Wilder. And they were married in 1946. And basically, it was around that time that she got a job singing on a radio show for CBS. And she got some offers. And one of the offers was to perform live at a place called Billy Reid's Little Club in New York. And that, oddly enough, was her first and last live appearance before a paying audience. Isn't that weird?
Wow.
Ray Darrell.
1968 was a pivotal year for Doris, because, in fact, that's the year that her husband, Marty Melcher, died. He basically had a heart attack, and then all the truth kind of started to spill out about all of his wheelings and dealings, and then the business advisor Rosenfeld was kind of, you know, implicated. And in fact, she in a flash realized everything she'd earned since 1951 was no longer there. She'd been hoodwinked out of, in fact, $22.8 million.
Gosh.
And apparently there was a TV series planned for her that supposedly she was not aware of. Because if you think back to the 60s, you know, TV was series and as opposed to movies, becoming a slightly new thing. And, in fact, it took until 1974 before a court ruling would award Doris damages for the malpractice and fraud perpetrated by that Jerome Rosenthal. So it was a long time coming to kind of get things sorted out. And in between time, she had to plunge into a TV series that she was unaware of.
Yeah.
And obviously, to try and keep the coffers up, not only did she do the TV series, which ran from 1968 to 72, but in fact she did a couple of TV specials as well. The first one was in 1971, and she had Perry Como on that.
I'd actually seen it, because they rerun it when I was down in Devon last time, so I watched it, yeah.
And the final one was in 1975, and that was with John Denver and some American, more common American people like Tim Conway, Rich Little and the Locker Dancers. And there we kind of have a bit of a gap, because between that and her final TV appearances, you know, was approximately 10 years, because later on, when she'd moved to Carmel, when all the financial things had been sorted out things were a little bit more on an even keel, her son, again, Terry Melcher, had kind of convinced her to try and record a new album. But in fact, they never recorded enough tracks for a new album, but it coincided with her being offered a weekly television series, but for a cable TV network.
Right.
And so they decided to use... I should point out that it was all focused on animals. Of course, Doris is a complete
animal lover.
Of course,
yes.
And,
I mean, can I ask you something? Because, I mean, you might know the answer to this. Did her love of animals start before any of her marriage breakups, or do you think she used this as a substitute for some of the poor human beings?
No, I think she'd always had a love of animals. It all kind of started way back in the beginning. I mean, it was a tragic beginning, actually. She had a little dog that you might remember I mentioned right back at the beginning of the program that she broke her leg when she was a teenager, and she had a dog as a pet then, and it was off the lead, and unfortunately, because she couldn't run after it, it ran in front of a car, and that affected her terribly.
No.
And from that point onwards, she was so kind of considerate to and wanting to kind of put animals above everybody else. Well, I think a lot of people could understand that.
I can definitely relate to that. Yes.
So no, it wasn't. I think it was there all the time. Yeah. And basically, you know, that kind of brings us up to the final TV series.
Radio.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, why not keep up to date with The Sound of Surrey by listening live at brooklandsradio.co.uk or through our free mobile app.